It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Conspiracy theories make for great stories. We love to watch TV shows and movies about them, and in the real world, there are many believers. A recent study from the University of Chicago found that 50% of all Americans believe in at least one conspiracy theory. This hour, we'll talk about some of the most well-known conspiracy theories, true and false, and we'll also try to find out what makes conspiracy theories so appealing. With me today is John Johnson. He is professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. Welcome back to the show, John.
Yeah, good morning.
And also Kevin De La Plante, associate professor of philosophy at Iowa State University. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to first talk about the term conspiracy theory, because it's a term that describes an idea that there is something more to a story. And it has been used in a derogatory way, but today we're using it to describe the kinds of theories that they can be true, they can be false. We're not trying to use it in a derogatory way. But do we know where this term came from, John?
You know, that's a good question, and I wouldn't want to speculate when it was first used. But certainly you can go back probably to the beginning of the American Republic and perhaps to the Western experience. Perhaps Kevin has some thoughts on that.
Well, the word itself means, it comes from conspire, which, and the spire part means to breathe, and the con part means to breathe together as a group. So I think the original etymology of the word is that when you have something you want to share with a small group of people, you get in close enough together so that you're speaking to each other very closely, so you're breathing together. And that's the an interesting image, actually, about how conspiracies tend to unfold, is that there's a notion of secrecy and a group of people sharing something and agreeing to hide it from other people.
Now, this research that I mentioned from the University of Chicago, I was surprised to find that 50% of Americans believe in at least one conspiracy theory. But it does feel like they are getting to be more and more popular all the time. Kevin, do you think this is something that is growing?
I think I'm not surprised by it, but I've also been sort of watching this unfold over the past 15 or 20 years, because I had a sort of an interest in these theories from a long time ago.
And what, explain that a little bit for me. What was your initial interest?
Well, maybe that would be, I was a grad student and I was studying the philosophy of science and other issues in theories of rationality. And so the topic of, you know, what makes a belief rational or not, and when people seem to have views that are run counter to traditional norms of rationality, there's a question about what explains why they have the views, why they persist, and so on. And so that whole topic is interesting from a sort of conceptual level. And so in the process, you start looking at examples like the moon hoax landing, for example, and it wasn't that long ago, and I was, you know, 2001 was with 9/11, and 9/11 conspiracy theories emerged fairly quickly. So, but the prevalence over the past 15 years of the views, I mean, they were marginalized much more so than they are today. And I think that's the question you're asking. And I would say there's a whole bunch of factors involved in this. Part of it is we've got, I think, growing a greater level of distrust and cynicism of government and other sort of mainstream authorities in the past 15 or 20 years. I think there's economic uncertainty and instability often seems to go hand in hand with conspiracy theory viewpoints, because it tends to, I mean, those who tend to adopt these views also tend to feel anxiety and sometimes marginalized. The internet is a huge source of this. When you've got more awareness of conspiracy views, you've got the ability, you've got people can learn about real conspiracy stories that are true, in fact. Mm-hmm. And so they come to modify some basic assumptions about things, about how, to what extent they can trust government and so on. And then these online communities and websites that are dedicated to reinforcing various views. You've got the rise of dedicated alternative media that is really sympathetic to, if not leaders among these viewpoints. You've got the mainstreaming of these views. For example, the Tea Party has a sort of a coalition of people who often are, say, highly cynical about the motivations and aims of government, and so that mainstreaming of that view and the view that there are nefarious aims of government is now more widely shared. And I think another thing, and that's the last one I'll mention, is that there's a much wider exposure to these super conspiracy theories, like New World Order theories, that believe that they're sort of narratives that integrate different conspiracy viewpoints under a larger conspiracy framework. And the mainstreaming of these views, I think, has had a big impact because it makes it so that to believe in one conspiracy makes it much more likely that you will believe others.
Interesting. Well, and John, I know that in your history classes, you focus on recent American history, post-1960s, and you talk about conspiracy theories with your students, but of course, during that time period, there was one of the biggest conspiracy theories that did turn out to be true, and that was Watergate. So do you think that having something like that happen in American government makes the environment much more favorable to believe other conspiracy theories?
The fact that there are some explanations that are borne out and become conspiracy theories that are validated is, of course, something that feeds, as Kevin indicated, the lust for more conspiracy theories. Take Watergate. There was, in the early 70s, a great deal of skepticism that a president could be involved in these activities, and I think the responsible folks on both sides of the political aisle were skeptical until the evidence came in. And as a historian, I followed that as a young professor in the early 70s. And I wanted to wait, as I thought most of the responsible historians did, until we had clear and convincing evidence. And ultimately, it would be the tapes that would validate what happened with Watergate. If I might add, as a recent U.S. historian, I am very interested and concerned about the Kennedy assassination, the assassination of President John Kennedy that we just memorialized after 50 years. And that's one conspiracy theory that continues to live and go in many different directions, mm-hmm. because there is so much evidence out there, but yet it has been carefully studied, and while the Warren Report, the first report on the assassination, might have been incomplete and in some ways mistaken, got the essentials right, I believe. And I could go into that more if you wish, but there is a basis for some explanations that initially might seem a little bizarre, but as a historian, I like to caution my students that we shouldn't jump to the bizarre, first of all. The consensus interpretation, the conventional wisdom, usually is correct.
Were you surprised by this number, 50%, or is that something that you see borne out in your students?
Oh no, I'm not surprised at all. Kevin pointed to several things that I would have mentioned about the ubiquity of conspiracy theories today, the internet, certainly, the 24/7 news cycle, and Charity, I have to blame the mm-hmm. media a bit for paying attention to many theories. But my students follow these subjects. They are interested in explanations. After all, a conspiracy theory purports to make sense out of strange and seemingly disparate elements. For example, it's hard to believe that 19 young men with box cutters could bring down jet planes and cause all of the horror and the tragedy of 9/11. But if you believe that there was some nefarious purpose behind it, if you believe that these individuals were following a master plan and that perhaps there were individuals who did things that we couldn't believe. There's a sense that that makes more sense. The Kennedy assassination, could Lee Harvey Oswald, a very tortured loner, bring down a president by himself without a great deal of help? The conspiracy theories make some sense. And as we've been saying, there is a skepticism about authority in the United States, and that has been around for quite a while.
Well, you mentioned 9/11, which of course was a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, this is the definition of a conspiracy, mm-hmm. is these men
right.
had a very long-term plan and they brought it to fruition. But you're saying that a lot of us needed to believe that there was more.
There was more.
It wasn't possible for this smallish group of
That's
people
right.
to
perhaps,
make a plan and carry it out.
Somehow someone wanted it to happen.
Someone in our own government.
That's one theory. I find that asinine, quite frankly. But
somehow this brings us comfort?
I think so, because we can accept the fact that there is a reason that goes beyond just, well, to use Nate Silver's term, noise. There is a lot of noise out there, a lot of chaos, and we're not comfortable, in my opinion, with chaos. We want an explanation, even if it's a nefarious one.
Interesting. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We're talking about conspiracy theories and why they proliferate, why they're so easy to believe, why they're so difficult to disprove. With me today, John Johnson, professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa, and Kevin De LaPlante, associate professor of philosophy at Iowa State University. We also want to hear from you this hour. Join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Are you a believer in a conspiracy theory or two? Where do you get your information? Is there a conspiracy theory you used to believe in, but you feel has been disproven? We want to hear your stories. Again, the number 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about conspiracy theories. A recent study from the University of Chicago found that 50% of Americans believe in at least one conspiracy theory. This hour, we're talking about some of the most well-known conspiracy theories and also why they're so appealing to us, why they're so easy to believe, why they're so difficult to disprove. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Kevin De LaPlante, associate professor of philosophy at Iowa State University, and John Johnson, professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. And just before the break, John, we were talking about how with some events that occur, they are so difficult to accept that people actually turn to conspiracy theories for comfort. And again, we also talked about conspiracy theories proliferating on the internet. I'm going to play just a clip from a video that was posted by a man named James Tracy of Florida Atlantic University. He received his PhD from the University of Iowa, and he's well known online for his theories surrounding mass violence, including the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, the Boston Marathon bombings. And it's very interesting to see how much of a following he has online. He is a professor and an academic, and he has some things to say that a lot of people would consider to be pretty out there. So let's listen to him for just a moment.
My colleagues and superiors really didn't want to talk about the issue that I was bringing up. It wasn't a matter of, hey, wow, maybe you have something here. Let's discuss it. After all, we're supposed to be, you know, we're supposed to be intellectuals and we're supposed to be sophisticated and let's talk about it. No, it was like, we do not want this controversy.
So again, that was the voice of James Tracy of Florida Atlantic University. And Kevin, you know, there's this perception, I think, we see in popular culture. We see images of conspiracy theorists who seem a little crazy, bonkers. But a lot of people believe in conspiracy theories. It doesn't mean, even if you believe in untrue conspiracy theories, it doesn't mean that it's that stupid people believe in these. There, a lot of very, very intelligent people study and believe in conspiracy theories.
Yeah, there is this portrait that maybe you have. I think Mel Gibson did a movie called Conspiracy Theory a while ago in which he sort of played the archetypal crazy conspiracy theorist. But there doesn't seem to be any correlation between IQ and a tendency to believe conspiracy theories. I would think that actually, and there's no dearth of academics. I mean, I would say, actually, that's not quite true. They are a minority among the academics set. Those who defend the more popular conspiracy, like 9/11 conspiracy or the Sandy Hook, shootings were false flags that were orchestrated by the government to create a reaction about gun control laws. That kind of thing is a minority view, but these guys are all pretty smart. And if you read their material, you realize that they're coherent. They give arguments, they respond to objections, and I think there is also some new findings that suggest that the smarter a person is, the harder it is to get them to budge from a viewpoint like this, because the ability to rationalize a viewpoint is made easier by being able to see various alternative stories that might make the facts be consistent with your chosen narrative, so that when you introduce new information that might be challenging to a view, people who are smarter actually have a better ability to reconcile that information and integrate it into their worldview in a way which makes it consistent.
Interesting. Well, and I mean, some of these conspiracy theories are so incredibly intricate with so many details pulled from so many different places. I mean, it takes a lot of research and creativity and investment to come up with that.
I think that there are two recurring themes in this view. One is that they reflect a cognitive bias that I think people are starting to look at more closely now, which is that people have a hard time accepting that events, the explanation for events can often be due to situational factors that are outside of the control of human agency. It could be chaotic factors, it could be random things, it could be intrinsically unpredictable events. We're more naturally inclined to want to explain events in terms of the actions of people and agency. And so all these sort of, and the broader conspiracies all have this feature that they take an event which is otherwise might have multiple explanations for it, and they focus on events, explanations that appeal to the actions, the intentional actions of human beings, and often a small number of human beings. And this is a studied bias in psychology, and I think a lot of the views reflect this. The other thing I see is, which is I think the case for, if you're going to argue that there's an element of irrationality here, I think there's a tendency to ignore the question about how these conspiracies might be possible, in the sense that as you scale up, as a conspiracy becomes more and more elaborate and grander, then it looks like you have a harder time of making sure that the conspiracy is pulled off. You have all the people who might be involved who would have to retain secrecy. You have all the indirect. I mean, think, for example, about, say, the moon landing, for example. So those who believe that the moon landing was faked in the 1960s would have to believe that there was this orchestrated series of events where the people at the highest levels of government came to believe that the U.S. project to land a man on the moon was going to fail, and that rather than suffer whatever international shame from this failure, or if the Russians did it first, they would rather orchestrate an event where they would do it in a studio and fake it and then beam out TV and so forth and radio to create this illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have to have a whole network of people involved who are conspiring to keep this secret. And they have to stay quiet about this for the rest of their lives and beyond that point, because the risk, if you were to disclose this, if there is a smoking gun that revealed it to be an in fact hoax, that would satisfy the public demand for that it would be, you know, they would be really disclosed in a public way. That would have been the end of the U.S. government, right? It would have been the most colossal, shameful event in American history up to that point. And so the risk is enormously high, which means that anyone who thinks that the government orchestrated this has to believe that they had incredible powers to maintain secrecy and control and manipulate the flow of information and people over long periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so interesting because, John, I know we talked just briefly about the conspiracy theories behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And, you know, in the case of the moon landing, we would have to have relied on all of these people to have been silent for so long. With the JFK assassination, people who knew the truth are dead and died very quickly after the events. So that's an environment that creates an even more fertile area for conspiracy theories, right?
It certainly is. Although a number of the people who had some contact with the assassination lived for a good long time. In the 1990s, President Clinton, largely in response to Oliver Stone's movie JFK, which was a whole snake pit of conspiracy theories, mm-hmm. President Clinton convened a panel of historians, appointed them to look at assassination records dealing with the Kennedy assassination. And the historians who were part of this looked at over a million documents dealing with transcripts and email, well, not emails then, but communications,
right,
between clandestine agencies. And most of these materials have been declassified and can be found online in the Assassination Records Review Board documents. And what they showed is an incredible chaos. But they, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most people who've studied the assassination records, they confirm what the Warren Report, in its partial and its incomplete way, determined, that Oswald acted alone.
Let's get to the phones, and you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We have a lot of people who want to join in this conversation. First up is Leve in Iowa City. Hi, Leve.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, and you are a recovering conspiracy theorist.
That I am. Years ago, back when I was in high school, I used to be really big into conspiracies. This was shortly after September 11th, so I was really big into that conspiracy. But one conspiracy led me to another, which led me to another, which led me to another, and it pretty much consumed my life. So,
consumed your life?
Oh, yes. I mean, after school, you know, I'd go home, I'd get on, you know, various websites, you know, look at all the conspiracy evidence that, you know, showed that, you know, it was a government cover-up for 9/11, or there was backward masking and, you know, pop music today, and just, you know, evidence of the Illuminati. So,
wow. So you have given this up?
I have. For the most part, I still kind of battle with it, because, I mean, there's a lot of things out there that seem, you know, very, very convincing, you know. So,
what was it that made you think, wait a minute, I'm buying into things that aren't true?
Well, it wasn't necessarily so much that. It was just the amount of time that I devoted to this. I just said, look, it's unhealthy. I, you know, need to do something else. I need to focus on not this.
Okay, so it's not so much that you renounced the theories, but just the lifestyle?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, some of the things I have come to think, okay, you know, maybe that is illogical, but, I mean, for the most part, you know, it's just something that I try to stay away from. Otherwise, I know that I'll be sucked right back in there, so.
So do you try to approach things with more skepticism now?
I would say, yeah, definitely.
Interesting.
Definitely.
Well, Leve, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And, you know, Levi brings up such an interesting point because people do get sucked into these conspiracy theories. And it is very, very difficult. If you know anyone who believes strongly in a conspiracy theory, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to convince them otherwise, no matter how convinced you feel you are. So why are conspiracy theories so incredibly difficult to disprove, John?
Well, the there's a scene in The Godfather, which is one of the great movies, where Michael, the new Don, is talking with his wife and their Kate, and they're having some problems. And Kate says to Michael, "Well, at least presidents and senators don't kill people like your organization does." And Michael says, "Kate, now who's being naive?" And that, to me, sort of encapsulates the problem dealing with conspiracy theories. Because if you are a critic of a conspiracy theory, then you're not searching enough in your analysis. You're being naive. And it's very difficult to disprove. Professor Tracy, the gentleman who you aired the statement from, is a very smart guy, and he is conversant with many different conspiracy theories, and he bounces back and forth from many of them as examples. My point as a historian would be that we are always dealing with incomplete evidence, things that that don't fit, and we need to be comfortable sometimes with ends that aren't tied down. We need to accept the fact that we'll not know everything, but we have to exercise the best judgment we can. Smart people, as you indicated, believe in conspiracy theories. Your caller, I think, has a lot of information, and I think he worked through, if I can read between the lines, he worked through some of the concerns he had, and became comfortable with less than assuredness and less than knowing everything.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. Jeffrey's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yeah, hi. I would just say that over the years I've had students who have these conspiracy theories about September 11, and one of the things I find is in terms of even September 11, you know, over a decade talking about it, probably 3% of the people that I've encountered could tell you the composition of the 19 hijackers, or could even tell you that 15 were from Saudi Arabia, for example. So what I find is that the entire population is uninformed and uninterested, for the most part, in being informed. I mean, you think September 11 is something people have heard about at least a few times, and they might be interested in the event itself. But so what I've done is tried to teach the same scientific method that we use when we mix two chemicals in a lab to when we study human behavior. And what the professor on your show just said, where he said judgment, and I always make him do in a fill-in-the-blank that you have to make informed judgments when you're studying historical events and use that same scientific method. And I think if that was taught better, it's sort of starting out in kindergarten, that we use the same method in the natural and social sciences, we'd have far less of that.
Interesting. Jeffrey, that's a really interesting point. And Kevin, I'll come back to you on that. Part of what makes conspiracy theories so confounding and these webs that get built is because, you know, as a general public, we are uninformed or underinformed. And yet people seem to hunger for information. And these conspiracy theories take a lot of investment to find out about them and learn about them and become informed about them. So there seems to be this paradox between not being that interested in current events and news, but being very interested in conspiracy theories. Kevin?
Yeah, I actually think there's an interesting question about to what extent the public is uninformed. Because those who tend to be attracted to conspiracy theories will go to the internet and start to read, and they'll quickly have consumed a great deal of information about an event or a theory that goes beyond what the average person understands about the event. And so from their perspective, they view themselves as much more informed than the general public. And to, there's an extent to which that's true. I think the connection to resistance that of to change is like twofold. One is a psychological factor that is when you come to adopt a conspiratorial worldview, often you, what you've done is accepted a premise or that is actually a very high level and deep premise. For example, a premise.
And you know what? We're going to have to finish this thought in just a moment and get to point number two about it as well in just a moment. We have to take a short break. We'll be back. We're talking about conspiracy theories today. My guests are Kevin De LaPlante, Associate Professor of Philosophy at ISU, and John Johnson, History Professor at UNI. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour we're talking about conspiracy theories, what makes them so easy to believe, what makes them so difficult to disprove. And with me, John Johnson, Professor of History at the University of Northern Iowa, and Kevin De LaPlante, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Iowa State University. And Kevin, I'm so sorry I interrupted you to take our break there, but we were talking about the hunger for information that people who dig into these conspiracies seem to have, or these conspiracy theories seem to have, and really their level of being informed.
Yeah. The point I wanted to make before the break was the first point was that often conspiracy views can be quickly tied to someone's deeper identity. For example, if you thought that you were like Neo in The Matrix, where you had discovered a secret that that the rest of the people were blinded to, that was important, that was morally important, that was existentially important, then that gives your life a kind of significance that it might not have otherwise. And so I think there's one of the factors that make people cling to these views is that the views quickly become integrated into their identity of who they are and what makes their lives meaningful. The other point I wanted to make is that there is a case to be made that a lot of these theories are genuinely unfalsifiable. And in the sense that this is a term that you learn when you study scientific reasoning. An unfalsifiable claim is one for which if you wanted to know what kind of evidence would lead you to believe the claim is false, and you ask yourself what facts, if you were to observe them or come to know them, would lead you to reject this view. And if you can't come up with a set of facts that would lead you to that view, then you could say that in that sense, the claim is unfalsifiable. Hmm. And it can come in different varieties. One way is in which it's objectively unfalsifiable in the sense that the theory makes claims that are so vague that they're consistent with any possible data. Another way is that the theory has so many moving parts to it that whenever new data comes in, you can tweak the parts so that the new data can become integrated and consistent with the theory. So you never have an occasion to have some evidence come in and say, yep, given that evidence, I have to reject something. And a lot of these theories have that feature. That is, there is very little common ground between someone who's a skeptic and someone who's a defender of a conspiracy theory, where they could agree to say, okay, if I were to persuade you of this, that would be a reason to reject your view, correct? And they have a very hard time coming to even an agreement about what would count as evidence that would play this role, because very often conspiracy views challenge even things like the observational evidence upon which some claims are going to be made. So, for example, they would challenge the data collection that went on in the, for example, 9/11. They would challenge the reports. They would challenge scientific evidence because they believe there might be a conspiracy among scientific bodies, for example, to distort evidence in favor of some agenda. And so if you can never identify a point at which there would be a neutral ground of evidence that could function to adjudicate between these competing views, then you have a really hard time moving people off that.
Right, right. John, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, getting back to Professor Tracy, if you listen to about an hour of Professor Tracy, which I've done on a couple of occasions, and I find it fascinating because he can reference maybe two dozen conspiracies in that time. And he bounces off the Tylenol scare to 9/11 to something else. And with every major pattern that of events that we have, there are holes. There is incomplete information. We're never going to know everything that we need to know. And there is a tendency, and the Kevin, I think, articulated it well, some people to jump to the bizarre, to take what limited information they have and go for the type of information or type of explanation that makes sense. And if that's a nefarious explanation, so be it. So my point, and I come back to something I said earlier, is that a historian has to look at the evidence and then exercise good critical judgment. And sometimes he or she has to say, I'm not sure, or the best evidence suggests this, but we'll never know for sure.
Well, you know, I know that both of you are skeptics when it comes to conspiracy theories, but I wonder if you also feel that we need to be skeptical when we are hearing the news, what is presented as the truth as well, John?
Yes, I think so. I think that skepticism is part of being a good American, distrusting authority, professing individualism. But that doesn't mean that you ignore facts or you take incomplete facts and jump to things that are implausible. Skepticism, yes. Critical thinking, yes. But taking evidence that is measured and drawing from the evidence what is logical and reasonable, but not making too many strange leaps.
I wouldn't say that I'm a skeptic about conspiracy theories, but I'll try to explain that. You know, Santa Claus, I don't want to shock any listeners, but Santa Claus, right, is a conspiracy, right? The conspiracy to not tell children about this. Planning a secret birthday party, like a surprise birthday party, is a conspiracy. There are lots of true conspiracies, and some of them have the features that conspiracy theorists are bothered by. For example, the idea of government involvement that has nefarious agenda. The U.S. government, among others, of course, has, there's COINTELPRO and MKUltra and these FBI and CIA programs that became known in the early 1970s to the public had a lot of these features. And I'm also sympathetic to some of the claims of conspiracy theorists where they focus on the role of propaganda in media, so that they'll identify this sort of pervasive manipulation of meaning and content and in through media, through spin, through propaganda, all of which I'm very sort of sympathetic to. That is, critical thinking about media is also about understanding the functions and ubiquity of propaganda. Where I differ, though, is that when the conspiracy scales up to something like a grand conspiracy theory or a global conspiracy theory, then the standard view about how to, say, account for, like, the general patterns of history of, say, the 20th century is that there's a level of social, economic, and institutional analysis that helps to explain those events. And the global conspiracy theorists don't want to do that. They want to explain the global structure of events in terms of the acts of a small groups of, say, international elites who are conspiring, have some agenda to bring about these events. And so they're puppet masters, you know, behind the scenes, and they reject the sorts of explanations that would be the default explanation for someone who didn't have that view. For example, an economic analysis or an institutional analysis or a geopolitical analysis. And so on the one hand, I'm actually fairly sympathetic to the call for critical analysis of media and so forth and establishment views that the conspiracy theorists ask us to do. But I find it the move to, say, Illuminati-style global conspiracy theory as unpersuasive and highly implausible. So my difference is how they justify that leap there. But I'm actually on board with a lot of the message about being critical, for example, about government messaging and media and so on.
And that's a message that we got from Jan in Mason City. She says that questioning September 11th, 2001 led me to learn of September 11th, 1970, where we sent U.S. troops to bomb the Chilean capital, murder the elected president, and put in our own selected dictator. I would think you'd want people to question what they're told. I am not a movie character.
It's a good example.
I think also we do tend to use this term right-wing conspiracy theories quite a lot. You hear that quite a lot in the media. And, of course, it really doesn't matter whether you are right-wing or left-wing. Conspiracy theories don't seem to have anything to do with ideology or political affiliation, or your willingness to believe in conspiracy theories in general doesn't seem to have anything to do with political affiliation. Kevin?
I think that they're so diverse that what you have are these overlapping circles where, for example, the vaccine autism claim that childhood vaccinations caused autism, that group, and then that came to be that there was a conspiracy to cover up or to hide this information, and a persisting conspiracy that was endorsed by a lot of people of varying political persuasions. Whereas, because I think it had to do, I mean, there was the root of that had to do with anecdotal evidence about
right. Well,
the
correlations. Well, you're speaking in past tense, although this is a conspiracy theory that is still very much alive today.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And is certainly costing people lives today.
I would say that if you look at the political spectrum from an emphasis on individual freedoms on one hand to authoritarian social control on the other hand, because that's often the way that they'll try to describe it, then libertarians on the right and on the left, because there's a kind of libertarianism that can wrap around from the left, tend to be more skeptical of government than as you move towards the center and towards the sort of like the center social welfare liberal or the moderate Republican, for example, who think that government has an important and central role to play in the state and structuring our lives, for example, for the public good. And so if you're politically aligned there and say that that's important and a feature of modern liberal democratic society that we have to live with, then you're less attracted to conspiracy theories that say that whole institution of government is corrupted and subverted at its very core, whereas there's lots of people who come from the sort of libertarian right and left who have that view. So I do think it does shade that way.
Okay. So, but it would influence which conspiracy theories you might be more inclined to believe in.
Exactly.
But not necessarily make you more inclined to believe conspiracy theories in general.
Right.
Could I jump in here?
Sure, John.
Charity?
Yeah.
Again, going back to Professor Tracy and his YouTube videos and other things, it would be difficult, I think, to listen to him and pick out what his political orientation is, because he has examples from all over, left-wing, right-wing, I'm not sure. And so I would rather ambivalent about whether there is a tendency towards conspiracy theories from either the political left or the political right. Take the Kennedy assassination, that there were other shooters. You can play that from either the left wing or the right wing, and it just really depends on how you want to look at it. There are so many holes in any grand explanation that there are places you can fill in those holes from your own political orientation. And the internet allows us numerous opportunities to plug those holes, or at least to poke some more holes.
You brought up earlier, Kevin, the moon landing conspiracy theories, that was faked. And now I know that we didn't have the internet when I was growing up, so I don't know when that conspiracy theory came about. We also have Holocaust deniers these days who will claim that the Holocaust didn't happen, and there was this vast conspiracy theory to convince people that it did. Is there a tendency for conspiracy theories to grow over time, the further an event is in the past? Is there more opportunity to create these theories?
That's interesting. I mean, in the sense that the farther past you go, then the harder time you have to identify evidence that could refute an explanation of what's going on, because the people are maybe dead, the records may no longer exist, and so what you have is you don't have access to direct evidence in which that you might have now. So I think, yeah, I think that is an opportunity for people to elaborate on theories that might be hard to refute. But I do think that conspiracy theories have a kind of life cycle. And the more persistent ones become adaptive. That is, they morph to a change to accommodate changing political times or new events. For example, New World Order theories go back 100 or so years. And what has changed is the viewpoint about the theory about the nature of the international elites who are responsible for engineering these global events. So at what time it was Jews and Freemasons, for example, although that's still a prevailing view among some quarters. And then evangelical end times advocates would often adopt a New World Order view that said that these events are governed by sort of they presaging the coming of the second coming, and there's an Antichrist coming, and so they might say it's Catholics or the Pope is the Antichrist or some other Marxist secular satanic sort of
right. So conspiracy theories are nothing new, but they do seem to be growing, and as you just said, they're incredibly good at morphing to suit the modern circumstances.
Yeah, I think the more narrow the scope is, the more unlikely it is that those will grow. If it's a well-defined narrow conspiracy, then you can might actually have some resolution about it, and it sort of fades from public view. But the grander the view, then the harder it is for evidence to play that role, and usually what it does, it gets scooped up like a grander theory sucks up these other theories like a vacuum cleaner. So even though you might not have a particular interest, for example, in the chemtrails conspiracy theory, which is the idea that the government is flying over with these planes and dusting us with these chemicals that are mind altering or brain altering or causing illness for some nefarious agenda. So that's a very specific thing. There's a whole cluster of people who focus on that. But that view gets sucked up into the broader New World Order or, you know, for example. And so it persists. It has life there as one part of a larger clockwork mechanism, if you will.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
Kevin De La Plante is an associate professor of philosophy at Iowa State University. John Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charity.
John Johnson is a professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.